Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and we have Sean in studio. So this is a show about what matters most in life: our minds, our feelings, our thoughts, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I will bring you the latest research about brain activity in sex addiction, mirrors that of drug addiction, and then I will speak to Andrew Susskind, a licensed clinical social worker and the author of Not About Sex, Moving from Isolation to Intimacy After Sexual Addiction. You can call me or Andrew on the studio line, 951-922-3532 if you like. But be sure to listen to my podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and share it with your friends and let them know that the podcast is there. Give us a review and contact me at fujianzain@gmail.com. Let me know your thoughts or any of the topics that you would like me to talk about or bring a guest. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Tip of the week. Now, this week, I've really experienced how when you dream, and you actually believe in your dreams, when you really know that you deserve to have and actualize this dream, and then you set it up as a goal and do not take anything less than what your dream is. And when you set up the action plan and make sure that you create what your dream is, in time, you will reach your dream and actualize it. Most of the people that I've worked with have a dream, but either they don't truly believe in their dream or they don't believe in their own capacity to reach that dream, so they keep it as a fantasy, or they don't think that their dream would be actualized because it's too big of a dream, or their conditions and situations are so far away from what they're actually dreaming of, and they'll see like it's not going to happen. Or they really did not think that they deserve their dream. So although they dream about it, but if they wanted to go through action plan to do it, they just don't think that I'm deserving of that. Or some resign in the fact that their dreams don't pan out when they say it should, and they just give up. So they'll actually try, but immediately, if it's not there for them, they think, okay, it's just not going to happen. See, it was just a dream. It's not going to happen. So they give up. And some people's negative belief about themselves does not allow them to move. But yet again, I keep seeing that when you dream and you know that this is your dream, this is something that is realistic, this is something that you can actualize, this is something that is actualizable, and you put your focus, attention, and it only takes you, your effort and belief. Then from there, you put the plan, the action, and you move forward. And yes, you'll make mistakes, you might fall, you might go up and down, but as long as someone holds on to the dream, and no matter how much they fall, they keep coming back up and they move forward to create it, the dreams do actualize. So dream, believe, plan, act, and actualize. And I promise you, it'll be yours. We'll be right back with the latest research on addiction.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
So this is the latest research. Pornography triggers brain activity in people with compulsive sexual behavior, known commonly as sex addiction. Similar to that triggers by drugs in the brains of drug addicts, according to a University of Cambridge study published in the journal PLOS ONE. However, the researchers caution that this does not necessarily mean that pornography itself is addictive. Although precise estimates are unknown, previous studies have suggested that as many as 1 in 25 adults is affected by compulsive sexual behavior, an obsession with sexual thoughts, feelings, or behavior which they're unable to control. This can have an impact on a person's personal life and work, leading to significant distress and feelings of shame. Excessive use of pornography is one of the main features identified in many people with compulsive sexual behavior. However, there's currently no formally accepted definition of diagnosing the condition. Researchers from the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cambridge looked at the brain activity in 19 male patients affected by compulsive sexual behavior and compared them to the same number of healthy volunteers. So the patients started watching pornography at earlier ages and in higher proportions relative to healthy volunteers. The patients in the trial were all people who had substantially difficulties controlling their sexual behavior, and this was having significant consequence for them, affecting their lives and relationships. In many ways, they show similarities in their behavior to patients with drug addiction. We wanted to see if these similarities were reflected in brain activity also. So the study participants were shown a series of short videos featuring either sexually explicit content or sports, whilst their brain activity was monitored using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which uses blood oxygen level dependent signal to measure brain activity. The researchers found that three regions in the particular were more active in the brain of the people with compulsive sexual behavior compared with the healthy volunteers. Significantly, these regions, the ventral striatum, dorsal anterior cingulate, and amygdala, were regions that are also particularly activated in drug addicts when shown drug stimuli. The ventral striatum is involved in processing reward and motivation, whilst the dorsal anterior cingulate is implicated in anticipating rewards and drug craving. The amygdala is involved in the processing of significance of events and emotions. So the researchers also asked the participants to rate the level of sexual desire that they felt while watching the videos and how much they liked the videos. Drug addicts are thought to be driven to seek their drug because they want rather than enjoy it. This abnormal process is known as incentive motivation, a compelling theory in addiction disorders. Now, as anticipated, patients with compulsive sexual behavior showed higher levels of desires toward the sexually explicit videos, but did not necessarily rate them higher on liking the scores. And the patient's desire was also correlated with higher interactions between regions within the network identified. The younger the patient, the greater the level of activity in the ventral striatum in response to pornography. Importantly, this association was strongest in individuals with compulsive sexual behavior. The frontal control regions of the brain, essentially the brakes on our compulsivity, continues to develop into the mid-20s, and this imbalance may account for greater impulsivity and risk-taking behaviors in younger people. The age-related findings in individuals with compulsive sexual behavior suggest that the ventral striatum may be important in development aspects of compulsive sexual behaviors in a similar fashion as it is in drug addiction, although direct testing of this possibility is actually needed. There are clear differences in brain activity between patients who have compulsive sexual behavior and healthy volunteers. These differences mirror those of drug addicts. Compulsive behaviors, including watching porn to excess, overeating, and gambling, are increasingly common. The study takes us a step further to finding out why we carry on repeating behaviors that we know are potentially damaging to us. Whether we're tackling sex addiction, substance abuse, or eating disorders, knowing how best and when to intervene in order to break the cycle is an important goal of that research. So we're going to talk more about this with our guest today. I'm excited to have Andrew Suskind, who's a licensed clinical social worker, somatic experiencing and brain spotting practitioner, and certified group psychotherapist based in West Los Angeles since 1992. Specializes in trauma and addiction. His recent book, It's Not About Sex, Moving from Isolation to Intimacy After Sexual Addiction, which was published through Central Recovery Press in June 2019. And that this joins his workbook from now on, Seven Keys to Purposeful Recovery, which was released in 2014. So what do we do this? Why don't we go into our break? And for all of you who are with us, just hang in there and listen to some of the, let's say, advertisements or things that we talk to you about until we figure out all of the tech. And then we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Dr. Fujian Zain is a psychotherapist, a marriage and family therapist, and a life coach with more than 27 years of experience. She is the author of the Awareness Integration Model, which has been researched and published in numerous international journals. Dr. Fujian has offices in Beverly Hills, Irvine, and Woodland Hills, California, and also consults online and by telephone. Make an appointment with her today by calling 818-648-2140 or go online to www.fujian.com. That's www.fujan.com. Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and we have Andrew Susskind with us, and we're talking about sexual addiction. And right before we left, we talked about, is there actually a diagnosis or a condition called sexual addiction, or is it just impulsivity, libido, testosterone, and so forth? Go ahead, Andrew, let us know.
Right. So thank you so much for asking this question, because it's been a controversy for so many years. And this is what has happened recently. I don't know if you're aware, but last summer, the summer of 2018, the World Health Organization finally came out with compulsive sexual behavior disorder as a new classification that they are including in their book that we use as clinicians for diagnoses. And that was a huge decision, because basically what it says that this is a real thing. This is not just made up. It's not about libido or people having a lot of sex. This is about a compulsive issue that causes people a lot of suffering.
And you also say in your book, it's not about sex, that it isn't about sex. That is so much underneath sexual addiction, that it has to do with our emotions, about our broken heart, about shame, about all of the other internal process that makes something that a behavior that could be very healthy and moving us along life, and it can be very enjoyable, that it turns to addiction, the same type of addiction that people have with food, or the type of disorders that they find with food, some process that should be normal for us as a human being. Like, using drugs might not be normal, using alcohol might not be normal, but sexuality and food, eating food, is something that ought to be normal. But there's something underneath, there's something that happens that change a normal process that a human has into an addiction. And can you share with us what your thoughts about it is?
Of course. So a few things. What we're really talking about is the kind of brokenheartedness that individuals have underneath that they're trying to escape or numb or avoid. And so sex addiction, and really like any addiction, is really an attempt to feel better, actually, or to feel less sometimes, or actually to feel more at other times. So whatever is happening, the compulsive sex or the compulsive hunt for sex actually is covering up usually some kind of trauma, could be something that happened in somebody's childhood, some kind of pain, something that is too difficult for them to really deal with. And so they feel disconnected. They often feel like they don't know how to have intimate relationships. And it's really an underlying suffering of intimacy. So some people even call it an intimacy disorder.
So when you talk about intimacy disorder and people who have challenges with intimacy, it seems that I'm hearing from you that when a person does not have the capacity or the ability, or they never learn, or they did, but because they got traumatized, this got disconnected, or they never got the type of an attachment that they were supposed to have, just because it just wasn't available, or that it was available and then something interrupted it, which created pain for them, that it disrupts the normal path of a human being's relationship with their body in the realm of sexuality and with other people in the realm of sexuality.
Correct. Right. So what we're talking about in terms of healing, I'm just going to move in that direction, we're looking at helping people who are struggling with this issue to integrate sex and intimacy into their lives in a healthier way. So oftentimes, intimate relationships are really impossible for folks who are dealing with sex addiction because all of their energy is really going towards avoiding intimacy, right? So what we're really hoping is that over time, they're actually going to want connection, because underneath of it, all of us, I mean, Brené Brown talks about the idea of that we're all biologically wired for connection. It doesn't matter if we have an addictive background or not, but we all have a longing for closeness. And so that's really the therapeutic direction that we're looking at, is how do we help these folks find ways of safely and productively creating closer relationships. And I know this because this is part of my own background. I've been in 12-step for sex and love addiction since 1994. And so it comes partially from personal experience and partially from being a therapist all these years.
Andrew, there's also a lot of anxiety, as I sense, with all sorts of addiction and this addiction. So there's an anxiety about or the lack of ability about that type of closeness. So there's an experience of feeling empty, feeling anxious, feeling shame inside. And there's this lack of the ability to create that connection, isn't it? So because when they have to face a part of themselves, they go toward a behavior to cover that part. And somehow, though, that behavior appears to be associated with pleasure, because we won't do a behavior if it's not associated in our mind with some right. some type of pleasure and maybe a delusion that after we go through this behavior, we're going to gain the kind of a meaningful contact or meaningful relationship and connection afterward. But isn't there also this kind of a catch-22 where there's this desire for connection, but there's really, if the connection also happens, that the high anxiety of not knowing what to do pulls back and then goes back into this kind of, again, the catch-22 cycle?
Absolutely. So let me circle back to something that might help our listeners understand something. So I have a shortcut for thinking about what sex addiction or sexual compulsivity really is, and it's three things. The first thing is that it's someone who wants to stop, but they can't, okay? So that's the first thing. The second is that there's consequences, that eventually the behaviors get so bad that that they lose relationships, they lose jobs, they hit bottom, is what we call it in 12-step. And then the third thing is that it's all-consuming. It's so obsessive that they can't get the idea of sex or looking for sex out of their mind. So that we're talking about a very all-consuming, dangerous, sometimes destructive or self-destructive type behavior. And so I agree with you. There's always going to be a lot of anxiety, a lot of difficulty finding ways to get close to others, because that's all new territory for them. I'm going to talk for a moment about the nervous system. So in the nervous system, what we ideally experience is a sense of buoyancy and regulation and feeling comfortable in our own skin. And addicts in general, but certainly those dealing with sexual addiction, feel dysregulated. They don't feel comfortable with who they are. They don't feel comfortable with relationships. They feel oftentimes either disconnected and depressed, or sometimes they feel rageful and highly anxious, even panicky, right? And so what we're trying to do as therapists or as clinicians is, how do we help them slowly find their way to a place of regulation inside of themselves where they're more comfortable in their skin? And so it starts oftentimes in the therapy room. The therapist is actually a mutual regulator, so to speak, for the client to start to experience somebody who's trustworthy and somebody that they can rely upon. And it doesn't matter whether it's a therapist or a sponsor or a coach or a pastor. It could be anybody that they feel they can lean on and really know that somebody has their back. But we're trying to move them from their island, from feeling really isolated and disconnected, to feeling more a part of things and that they can trust others one by one by one. And actually, I believe that relying on reliable people is one of the greatest anxiety reducers.
Can I suggest something I'm hearing from you? And I just wanted to make sure that I'm hearing this and the audience are also hearing this. And if not, then shift it for us. Am I hearing that you're saying that if a person who supposedly has sexual or diagnosed with sexual addiction or some sort of sexual compulsivity, that if they have and create, let's say, a great relationship, which is deep relationship, that they feel comfortable with someone, that they could be heard, they could be seen for who they are, and you're talking about not a non-sexual relationship, because you were talking about, you know, whether they create this relationship with a therapist or a counselor. So if a person has the ability to create this type of a bond with another human being and they're seen, then their anxiety will subside. And yes, I agree with that. But does that also like bridge, and you're suggesting that would also bridge it to the sign that if their anxiety comes down because they have a fulfilling relationship on one side, which is a platonic relationship and non-sexual, that it also calms down the complex aspect of their compulsivity and their desire and their addiction?
I do believe so. I've seen that many, many, many times. It's hard work, because if there's really a terror of intimacy, I'm not talking fear of intimacy, I'm talking a terror of intimacy, it has to be very, very gradual. And so, for instance, I agree with you, romantic relationships usually are off the table for a while, because it would be too overwhelming to try and get involved with somebody romantically right off the bat. But if somebody is giving up their behaviors, their out-of-control sexual behavior, then if they establish one relationship at a time and just literally put one foot in front of the other and start to notice, oh, so this person really has my back, this person is somebody I can really count on, that's when the nervous system calms down. That's when the nervous system starts to say, ooh, I kind of like this. I don't know what to do with it yet, because I'm not used to it. But you're right. It's just one person at a time. Sometimes it's having a pet, literally, a pet that you can count on and that you can take care of that also regulates the nervous system. So there's all kinds of different ways to help move towards more emotionally reliable relationships, but yes, it takes a lot of time, and it's about building blocks.
So there is this part that you said that again, I'm hearing you say, and I've worked with addicts that the pleasure that gets created, assumable pleasure, that it gets created by the use of that behavior, whether it's sexuality or drug use or any type of addiction, keeps pulling them into that behavior, although there's a lot of work that it's done. And what I've seen with addiction is that when they do have a support and they are able to dissociate the concept of pleasure with this short-sighted behaviors adding that type of an association of pleasure to a different type, such as a meaningful relationship, which at the beginning they don't know what it is, and it might be awkward at the beginning, and it might be anxiety producing, but as they feel comfort in it and they get a little bit of feel of this, then They can associate now pleasure to this other type of an experience, but there now has to also be a bridge into, can a platonic relationship shift, or can, is there a place that we could bring these two together and their work on themselves? Because I've seen people who have great relationships in some sort, but it's almost like completely dissociated from another part of them, which has to do with their addiction. So they have split off types of relationship. Like they can have had amazing relationship with their family, but they can't have, when it comes into a romantic relationship, now this has a whole different feel, as if this is a whole different genre with its own boundaries. Do you see this type of a split when you talk to people or work, or is it mostly you believe that regardless it's the same spectrum, that no matter what, if a person really experiences true, authentic intimacy and closeness and attachment with another human being, that ultimately they can take this and bridge it to all of their relationship, including romantic and sexuality?
Right. No, I think it's a great point. And what I have seen is it takes a lot of time. I think the reason why 12-step has been so popular all these years is because it's an automatic community, and generally somebody gets a sponsor, which is someone that they admire and they want to work the 12 steps with. And, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to healing from compulsive sex. So I want to make that clear. There's not one way that it works best. But what I've seen and what I believe is so important is to start feeling that sense of trustworthy people in your life, and that sense of, oh, I'm not alone in this. I can really lean on others. I can ask for help, which is huge. And to find ways of, you know, establishing relationships that are really safe, that feel really nurturing, and that are in their best interest when it comes to whatever kind of healing path they want to take. I just wanted to add one other piece to this that I think is really important. You know, I don't always call it sex addiction, because it doesn't matter whether we call it sex addiction or compulsive sex or problematic sexual behavior or out of control sexual behavior. What I wrote my book about is really the idea that when people stop the behavior, that's the starting gate. That's really where people start to look deeper inside and look at issues like grief and shame and narcissism and nervous system regulation and boundaries and all that good stuff that they really, in some ways, are delayed. They haven't learned them earlier in life and are learning them in recovery. And so I agree exactly with what you said, is that I believe that by creating some foundation of relationships that feel more nourishing, that feel more healthy, that eventually, and I'm usually talking about a year or two after they get sexually sober, to consider romantic relationships with some coaching, with some people around them that can help them through it, because it's usually very foreign territory.
Wonderful for clarifying that, because I also have had the experience working with addiction that the behavior, while the person is doing the behavior, there's so much that they could do. But ultimately, the real work on someone, people work on themselves after there is a possibility of saying, that's it, I need to stop. I need to get help and I need to stop. Now, people who get to a point of I need help, they're not necessarily getting help to stop. Most of the time, they're still kind of bargaining around, do I need to stop, or can I have another quick fix in doing it another way? But yes, if there's no way of really looking at underneath all of these issues unless someone has stopped, so right. That all of these issues arises and they're not shut down again by that behavior. So if we have anxiety, if we have shame, if we have all of that, and then we go through our addictive behavior and then go through the cycle, we always are going through the cycle. We're not necessarily holding on to a space of really feeling the emotion, so therefore we can go back and really work on those emotions of emptiness and shame and move towards something else. So your book, not about the sex, moving from isolation to intimacy after sexual addiction, presupposes that someone really is looking at the consequence that they are experiencing. One, maybe sexual diseases, legal action, their marriages, their relationship, and more than anything, the emptiness that they actually feel inside and the depression and anxiety that gets created by that addiction, that they get to a place of saying, you know, I'm done with this and I deserve to have a, you know, have my sanity back, in a sense. And from there, there's a whole different process that begins, which is recognizing what's underneath and attempting to develop a relationship, which is a platonic relationship, but just to experience the closeness, attachment, and intimacy in a safe way so that they can, the anxiety calms down and they can have a little bit of an experience of what that even is like before they can also bridge that into their relationship, romantic relationship. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
That's absolutely correct. I want to add to that that some of my clients who come in to see me who have stopped the behaviors really are starting to learn things that they didn't learn as little kids. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm talking to very young children, and these are people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, et cetera, because they're making up for lost time. And so oftentimes I call it reparenting, that when a client comes in who hasn't learned certain life skills as a kid, whether that be boundaries or whether that be learning about how to trust people or how to ask for help. I mean, very basic things. That's really where we start. And I think what you said is right on, because these are folks who really are still suffering. I mean, I always say that the starting gate begins when they've stopped the behaviors and admitted that there's a problem. That's where the real hard work begins.
Yes. So the work, as I hear you, and you state in your book, in a sense, it takes about a year or two after they make a decision that out of the impulse that they will not go and have that sexual behavior, whether it's with another person or pornography or any type of a sexual behavior that they have that covers or shut down their emotion. And that after that, not only that for a short term, they might have created some sort of a pleasure, but it turns into shame and guilt and, you know, sadness and really putting themselves down and more consequences. At that point, when they finally make a decision that I need to get help, it takes about a year or a year and a half or 2 years. And it does take to create that relationship with someone such as psychotherapist or a counselor, AA, the community that could support, friends that can support. And this way, the person, in a way, tries to find themselves and who they are. And then from finding themselves and into a relationship which is healthy, then they can move forward with that. What are your suggestions also for people who are, and I know you have a workbook that you published 2014, which was 7 Keys to Purposeful Recovery. And what would you be able to say to our audience about people who are also in the bargaining stages? Like, they know, they get the consequences. At times they fall into that and they go back. And I say this because, you know, the concept of bargaining around this and relapse is something that we all know that happens in addiction. So what would your suggestions be for someone in that stage?
Right. When somebody is still bargaining, I would ask a few questions. One of the most basic questions is, what is it that you really want? What do you want out of your life? What is it that you want from this point forward? Because there has to be a soul searching, and ultimately there ideally will be a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning that will be a more advanced part of recovery, but that they can start asking themselves about, and with a therapist or a counselor or a coach. Those, I call them the big ticket items, can be, that dialogue can begin. So that's part of what I would check in with. Another thing is, you know, is this working for you, right? If they're still bargaining and they're still doing some behaviors that are risky or dangerous, how is that working for you? And if they say, you know, it's working well, I'm enjoying myself, okay, well, maybe you'll come back another time to talk to me. But most clients who make it to my office will say, you know, I'm really lonely. I'm profoundly lonely, or I'm sad all the time, or I'm anxious all the time, right? So that's our opening. That's the window of opportunity to say, oh, I see. So let's look at how this serves a purpose in some way, but let's look at how it's causing you suffering so we can decide what direction we're going to go from here. So there's not a cookie cutter answer to what you're asking, but I think it's important for our clients to start to ask those important questions about why would I want to give this up, and what do I really want?
Absolutely. And I also think that there's this added concept of knowing that I don't have skills. And as long as I don't have new skills in how to handle relationships, then I'm just going to continue to do exactly the same thing. And I will go into some sort of a relationship, whether it's a one-night stand with someone or whether it's a pretense of a relationship or a relationship with an object or a relationship with my computer and pornography.
Right.
So somehow, as long as I don't know any other skills, that's all I know, I'm going to do that. So knowing and learning more skills in how to relate
right.
always helps expand this type of relationship, where in that moment, then maybe they'll see that other types of relationships might be more helpful into fulfilling the emptiness inside versus just, you know, having the relationship again with an object or an act and not really the human beings that are out there, not connecting with themselves, nor the human beings that are out there in order to have that type of a sexual and emotional satisfaction.
That's right. And two things I'd like to add. So one piece is that when a client comes in to see me, hopefully they're coming in because they're ready and that they're looking for hope, right? And because I've been doing this almost three decades, generally I've seen enough people who have really found a way to have a more fulfilling, expansive life. And so that instilling of hope is huge, that they can see, oh, this person has really been around the block a while, and he's seen people get better from this. Maybe I can get better. So that's one piece. The other thing I want to be very careful about is I never want to pathologize sex in any way. So that's why I actually have a little bit of difficulty with the term sex addiction. I don't want to pathologize it in the sense that there's nothing that I'm going to do with a client that is about deprivation or is about total abstinence. You know, sex and food and money are parts of life. And so in recovery from compulsive sex, it's important for a client who's bargaining to understand that there's a future. They may not be able to look at it yet, but there's a future where sex can be a pleasurable and fulfilling and fun and spontaneous part of their life. But it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a lot of hard work.
I totally agree, because I think that this sex addiction, food addiction, and spending type of a conversation with money, I think that you're absolutely right that it's not something that we could just talk about abstinence as we do for drug and alcohol type of addictions. It is true that this is part of life, and the distinct difference that a client, a person, any of the people who are listening or watching us today really looks at is learning a new way of relating to sexuality and food and money versus the unhealthy way that the person has gotten used to, let's say, and that's the only way that they know or is the way they keep choosing because they're getting some sort of a benefit, but they're really not getting all of the benefit. And maybe when they know another pathway, which they'll not only get the benefit they're getting now, but also get all the, you know, surrounding benefits, that they hopefully, and most of the people will choose the more versus the less. If you know that you can gain so much more with relatedness and all of it, then you wouldn't want to settle for less of just compulsivity with a minor concept. It must be that people either think they can't get it or they don't know how to handle it or they don't deserve it. And all of, you know, some of the above and more for them. And not having the skills to be able to do that. So having the knowledge that more is available, actually. And in these cases, they might not do this behavior for a while in order to gain the other side. But at one point, they can bring some of the behaviors that they have into a system that could be healthy for them.
That's beautiful. I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly what I would say, that we're really presenting an idea that they can have a more satisfying, fulfilling life in general. And I often say that I'm holding that intention for them. They may not be able to grasp it themselves right away, but that, yeah, we're holding the intention that sex and intimacy and life in general can be more enjoyable and more satisfying.
Yes. So everyone, please go get the book. It's Not About Sex, Moving from Isolation to Intimacy After Sexual Addiction. Andrew, how can people find you?
Well, they can find me on my website, which is westsidetherapist.com, and that's all one word, singular. And the book is available on Amazon, Audible, or Kindle. So all kinds of options.
Beautiful. 1 minute of something that you haven't said and you really want our audience and listeners to know about your book or about your work, something they need to know.
Sure. Thank you. The book really is a passion project. It's something that I had been thinking about for a long time because I've been in the 12-step rooms for 25 years and I've been a therapist for 28 years. It's really based on a lot of experience with folks in my therapy practice and in the 12-step rooms who are sober, sexually sober, but still suffering. And so I came up with all of the topics in the book to really help those who want to have more fulfilling, expansive lives. And I've been told that it's not only applicable to those in sexual recovery, but also all kinds of addiction. Folks who are in recovery from various addictions seem to be gravitating towards the book as well. So I'm really pleased with how it's been unfolding.
I also would love to suggest for people who are married and are in a relationship, but are doing sexual or behaviors that are out of integrity within the marriage, to also read this book. Because I think that many people associate sexual addiction only with people who are single and having promiscuous kind of relationship and one night stand and from here to there and they can't stand it. But there are a lot of people who supposedly are in intimate relationships. They're actually within the structure of relationships and they still have those type of, they have sexual addiction. So I also suggest for those people to go and look at your book, because I think that your book really works with the underlying issues that show up, and I'm sure that it would support people to recognize some of those matters that, you know, issues that matters for them underlying. I work with a lot of couples, and I see this a lot, where there's a kind of a, you know, denial on a part of someone, but they did get married because it's the thing to do. And, you know, you want to create a family, so they go ahead and get married, but they never worked on the other part, and they just kind of hide it from themselves and their relationship. And obviously it creates a disaster for the whole family system. And that's one of the consequences that gets created. So if you're listening, or if you know someone that might have these issues, I would really recommend for you to recommend them. Not About Sex, Moving from Isolation to Intimacy After Sexual Addiction, from Andrew Susskind. Thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. And for everyone who's listening and or watching us, it's... I really suggest that for us to really have the capacity and the ability to look deeply at ourselves and see that we deserve to live a healthy life. We really deserve to have a healthy life. And there are so much information, people, counselors, therapists of every kind, with every expertise, available for you to really create an amazing life for yourself. So the help is out there, whether they're through books or videos or counselors, whether you can go to their offices or work online with online therapy and counseling, all of it is available for you. So don't cut yourself short. Please take care of yourself and create an amazing life for everyone around you. Till next week, take great care of yourself. Bye-bye.